What's up, everyone? Welcome back to the Rockcast, sponsored by Onyx Hunt Mapping. Today we have Nick Sabo on, and we're going to talk about mule deer in the low country. So thanks for hopping on, Nick.
No problem, Jordan. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. So yeah, I think I thought you were the man for the job for this one. I've been getting a lot of questions. You know, I think like talking about mule deer in the higher country or in the mountains gets kind of hammered to death.
And it does, sure.
And in the lower country, it just doesn't as much. And I don't know if, you know, it's just there's not maybe as much public land or just not as many people think of mule deer when they look off the interstate in South Dakota and it's pretty flat.
Right.
But they're around. So I thought I would just talk to you about that a little bit. Do you want to just give a little bit of background on yourself and like how you like to hunt mule deer and where you've hunted them, things like that?
Yeah, I'd be glad to. I started hunting in Ohio. That's where I'm originally from. Mainly just bow hunting when I was a kid, bow hunting out of tree stands, hunting whitetails, and then had some pretty good success with that. Not a lot of people in my family actually hunted. My dad never did. He was more into fishing, and had a couple friends when I was real young in school that had some bows, and I thought that would be interesting. So that's how I got into archery. And then ever since then, it just kind of took off. So I joined the military and was stationed in Alaska for 5 years. Did some really cool hunts up there, enjoyed my time. And then I got stationed here in South Dakota. And I knew that there was pretty good hunting out in quotations out west, from Ohio. This is way out west. And I've always had interest of coming out here. And when I got down here, I just kind of started exploring. And to your point, you know, driving down the interstate, looking off, you're like, I don't know. It just looks like a bunch of rolling hills and fences and cattle, you know, really not a whole lot holding here. And I was way wrong. As far as once you get off and get into some of these, you know, cedar draws or badlands type country, for one, it's in my mind, gorgeous country, but two, there's little cracks and crevices that hold some pretty impressive mule deer out here. And so that's kind of what got me in it. And I've been doing that for probably 6 or 7 years now with pretty good success. And I love it.
That's fantastic, dude. So, So you've hunted deer in the higher country too.
You know, I haven't hunted deer. I mean, I've been on multiple sheep hunts, done some caribou stuff, hunted black bear. I've never done a high country mule deer hunt. It's something I've always wanted to do because I'm a glass nut, right? Like I'm always on a tripod, running binoculars or spotters, picking apart, you know, landscapes. And I love doing it. And so I definitely that the high country stuff appeals to me. I mean, I watch a lot of really good, you know, like the Western Hunter. I watch those guys like on TV and stuff doing some high country hunts and keep up with all the social media guys that do a lot of it. And I can see some major differences to what they do versus what I do, but I can also see some similarities. You know, it's not worlds different, but I would say that it's definitely, you know, has its differences.
For sure. You know, one of the biggest things that I've seen is I think what can be daunting is like in the high country, you know, you hear people talk about the big, like beautiful basins and like all this stuff. And I mean, there's deer in those places, but you know, we've talked about how there's not a lot of deer in those places. They're like more in the, they could be more down in the trees, but it seems like it's a little bit simpler to find places to glass bucks up. And I think some of that is because there's so many places that are treed up. So like, you don't have a choice but to look in like the places where you can see, obviously.
Correct.
Whereas like, dude, Nebraska, where I'm from and like up where you're at, there's no trees really.
Visibility is not an issue, you know, and I tell people all the time, you want to go look at some deer, let's do it. We can go find deer. That's not the problem, but I don't have a lot of, you know, stuff to sneak behind or get behind or, you know what I mean? It's a little bit different in that regard as far as, you know, making moves on deer. You got to be very calculated, and not that you're not calculated in high country, but to your point, you may only be able to glass 20% of a 6,000 acre basin. You know what I mean? Just because of all the trees and everything like that.
Right.
I can glass 90% of mine. You know what I mean? It's not a problem.
Yeah. So I think it can be like overwhelming to people to find mm-hmm. deer, or they look at it and they don't even know where to start because it all looks fairly similar, you know, like there's not big terrain differences, you know, mm-hmm. from, I don't know, 6,000 feet to 10,000 feet. Like it's 4,000 feet here. And it's like that everywhere,
right.
With some draws and stuff like that. So, mm-hmm. I guess, you know, starting out, I put a deal out on Instagram, and one of the biggest questions that a lot of people put in was like, how do you e-scout for that kind of thing? Mm-hmm. How do you go about, I guess, just your scouting as a whole, like if you're going to go into a new area, what do you look for?
Yeah. So like, I mean, I've done it, you know, I spent a lot of hours on the computer looking at things, and something that I learned early on, like when I was in Alaska is I just oriented to ridgelines, because once you get up there, you can really get a lot of bang for your buck as far as travel, right? You get up on a ridgeline and move. So my eye usually gravitates when I'm looking at, say, a topo map or a Google Earth or whatever. I want to find a lot of ridgelines that make sense and something that I can cover, you know? So I'll look at that on like Google or even like Onyx or whatever. Mm-hmm. And I'll start looking at ridgelines, looking at ways I can travel. Obviously it's no secret, like looking at access. I don't want to even waste my time in a lot of places that are quote unquote easy to get to, you know what I mean? Like get out of your, you know, out of your comfort zone and be like, okay, like this hillside is going to be a bear to get up. And I doubt that a lot of people access this property from this direction. So let's go up there, you know, let's go up there and start looking. And so that, you know, just thinking, try and think differently, you know, cause you're hunting public land, you're hunting in your competitions, a lot of other people. But if you start looking at land and try to think, okay, what's the hardest way to get on this place? Or what's the hardest possible way for somebody to get there? Take that route if you can, you know, if that's a possibility for you. That's always kind of, I've done that a lot of times, and it's like, man, I've been here 5 minutes, and those are two bucks that are shooters in everybody's book, you know. Not that happens all the time, but you know, those are just an instance where you can use Onyx and stuff, look at access, look at old roads, you know, figuring out is that an active road or not out here, you know, trying to figure out, are they running cattle here yet? Are they going to, you know, like that's a big driving factor, you know, like talking to, you know, yes, it's public land, but a lot of ranchers and stuff run cattle on some of that mm-hmm. stuff. And so, you know, looking at, and don't be afraid to stop and talk to somebody, and just, you know, if you see a guy feeding on a tractor, just, I've done it multiple times, and most of the time they're the nicest people you ever meet. And they'll tell you, hey, yeah, oh yeah, I'm going to have cattle there in November. So there you are in August. And you know, say you're scouting for your rifle tag, you found some sweet spot, and then you hike in there, you know, a day before, and you're greeted with about, you know, a 400 head of cattle, and they're in a deer in sight. Not saying deer don't necessarily hang out with cattle, but those are just things that I've run into where I thought I had it all figured out, but I didn't, mm-hmm. you know?
Yeah. So do you would like, so after you e-scout or whatever, and you've kind of mm-hmm. got a feel for the place, and then you go out and are, you know, running the country, which I think mm-hmm. is obviously super important, just running the roads and getting familiar with things. I've tended to like draw a circle around like some water sources.
Sure.
Draw a circle or a line like out from fields, like farm fields and things like that.
Yeah.
And start there, especially in the mornings and the evenings, and then watch those deer where they're going. Cause I think like a lot of in the high country, they're not going to travel too far. Right. I mean, they're mm-hmm. going to go from this nice green grass spot, and then they're going to roll into the trees and bed. And that might only mm-hmm. be like 200 yards, 300 yards, whatever. I'm sure some other ones travel, but mm-hmm. down here, it seems like, you know, we'll have deer that I see leave a farm field, and they'll go up into the hills and like start trekking out across pasture, and dude, they'll go a mile before they bed down.
Yeah. Yeah. I've had almost identical same experience. Some places that I hunt, I set up in like the cedar draws, like I'm always on some, like in the mornings, I'm always on some form of a high spot with, like I said, 12 by 50s and a tripod. That's just how I start every day. But there's some spots where I hunt here that the bucks don't even come into the draws until about 8:30, because they've been walking from their water source from daylight, right? So like they'll come from, you know, from back, I don't know how long it takes them. They're getting water, to your point, about a mile and a half away. And it takes them that long just to get to the cedars to where they're going to bed down. So the first few times I hunted it, I was like, man, this looks like there'd be deer here. I've found sheds here. Like, why am I not seeing anything? Well, it's because I stopped looking at about 8:45, you know, starting at daylight. And yeah, you see some small bucks, but you're like, man, there should be some shooters in here. And here they come over the hillside, you know, over the ridge line, you know, walking from water or alfalfa fields or something like that. So yeah, they transition a lot, you know, compared to maybe a deer that spends the majority of his life in some sweet basin where he's got everything he'd ever need.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Yep. I've always thought that was pretty interesting. Like after hunting the mountains a little bit and learning about those deer, and then, you know, learning from guys like Robbie, especially about like the great big deer where he's like, yeah, they're not going to leave. We're hunting a very small area. And there's been a bunch of times where he's like, yeah, you just like keep hitting it and hitting it and hitting it. And you'll see the deer like in August and maybe it's in October, but you just keep hunting it. And then he'll pop up and he's right in the, you know, very close mm-hmm. to the same spot. Yeah.
But yeah, so those deer, and I had that, I actually had that this year is I do a lot of scouting in August. I think that's a super important thing, you know, is go check out some areas that you're thinking about hunting early and rule out the places that you're just not seeing deer, you know, and you can figure all that out pretty soon. But, you know, I saw some deer in August and I was really picky this year. I didn't really want to shoot a deer that I wasn't like 100%, you know, you see him in the glass and you're like, there he is. Like, that's the deer I want. You know, I was really waiting for that this year. And, all of a sudden, like I just kind of hit a dry spell in October and a little bit into November. And then, you know, like to your point, keep hammering at those spots. And there he was. I saw him on like December 16th, you know, and that's a deer that I hadn't seen before, even in August, but they'll come to those good spots, mainly just because the does live there year round probably. But, you know, cause we don't get a ton of travel, out of say, you know, a couple thousand acres, you know, that mm-hmm. deer isn't, other than maybe like you're saying a water run or something like that. But, you know, if you start getting familiar with some of these lands and figure out where those does are, you know, come all those classic times of year where, you know, during rut, pre or post or whatever, you can, you know, just spend your time around that neighborhood of does and there's going to be some visitors, you know, it's just a good way to go at it.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Yeah. I would definitely say like, the home range of a buck, at least around, you know, around here, like, or in Nebraska anyways, mm-hmm. is pretty big. Like, I don't want to say 10 miles, but it wouldn't surprise me.
Correct.
They just travel more. It seems like, they just travel more than, in all times of year too. Right. Like that's something, another question a bunch of people asked is they're like, you know, we don't have trouble finding the deer in November, of course, because they're around does and just a little bit, mm-hmm. they're dumber, basically.
Yeah.
But they're like October, September, can't find them. Don't know mm-hmm. where they are. Mm-hmm. And I don't know. I mean, I don't think they're far. I just think that they're a little sly.
No, they are. And that's what, and I've talked about this on a few other, or just one other podcast that I was on, but you know, they are sly, you know, figuring out where those bachelor bucks, a lot, at least in my mind, they're pretty patternable, you know, in the early season, but they're also very like direct, you know, as far as like, they go to their food source, they come back in their draw, you know, they eat, they bed down, come evening, they go back to their food or water source and come back. And if you're not lucky enough to stumble upon that small piece of the pie that those deer are frequenting, well, you're just not going to see them. Now, once you find them, you're like, okay, I think I got these boys figured out. But mm-hmm. sometimes it takes a lot of work, especially on, you know, large public land to like where everything looks good. Everything looks like it should have deer in it. And you got to find those spots within the spots that those, for whatever reason, that those deer like. Maybe they have some areas that just have shade at more, a little more hours than the rest of the property does, you know, like you just trying to figure those out, because I just feel like those bachelor bucks are just so much more efficient, like going from A to B, because they're not thinking about anything else. They're not going and checking out does. They're not going doing anything else. They're just kind of chilling, going, eating food, coming back and sleeping. And sometimes it's hard to find them. But when you do, you usually have pretty good luck at that point.
Right.
At least I have.
Yeah. It seems like they're in like canyons with like really green grass in the bottom. Like a lot of times, yeah. You know, like the top and the stuff that you can, you know, really see a long ways in, they might travel through that, but I haven't seen them, you know, just stand on the top of a, mm-hmm. you know, just like a regular grass hill or whatever, and just eat for a long time. Seems like they're usually traveling at that point. So there's one field that I've watched deer come out of. They climb, I mean, not the couple hundred feet, maybe into the sand hills. Mm-hmm. They get up into this high set of hills, and where you find them bedded and feeding is in like a little bowl. In like a little bowl, like,
yeah,
you know, 200 yards,
yeah,
maybe 300 yards, and mm-hmm. it's like a hole in the earth basically. And mm-hmm. the only way you're going to find them is if you're like in the exact, like the right spot to find them.
Yeah, you would drive right by that in a pickup, you'd cruise by that in a four-wheeler. If you didn't know it was there, you would, it looks like nothing from a distance, right? It just looks like it's just a little roll in the hill, but you get over there. And I've had that exact same thing happen here out on the grasslands, where it's just like, why is there deer there? You know, like why is there, but it's worked for them because most of the people on the grasslands drive right by, you know, no big deal. And they haven't, you know, they don't have a lot of pressure in that open. And plus it's really hard to get in there to arrow one, you know, you just, there's no great approach, you know, it's just like, well, I'm just not even going to bother until they get into somewhere else, because, you know, there's just not a great way to get at them with an arrow anyway.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I definitely think it depends, but we've had a heck of a lot better luck, like setting up for an ambush, you know, mm-hmm. watching them for a couple of days and kind of figuring mm-hmm. out where they like to, you know, cross a fence or where they like to go through in the hills. Cause a lot of times they're following cattle trails, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Right.
And kind of set up that way instead of mm-hmm. just trying to stalk them out in the wide open, because you're literally hiding behind blades of grass and it's just, not a good situation.
Yeah. If you want to do that, just frustrate yourself and low punting. But, you know, as far as that goes. But yeah, I've done the ambush thing. A lot of times I'll stalk deer in beds as long as I have wind. I will approach them, you know, arrow wise, if I have wind and I feel good about it and I know exactly where that deer is. But there has been twice where it's been in the evening, where I get a deer that's feeding on top of, we'll say the top third of a draw. And I'll sit there until I can establish a direction that deer is going. And usually it's either he's going up and out or he's going down and in. And as long as I can establish which way he's going, I mean, I've literally ran, you know, got a couple draws in and like ran out of breath and got down to that draw and waited on him. And sure enough, here he comes down the draw that's maybe 90 to 100 yards wide and maybe 30 to 40 yards deep. You know what I mean? And then I'll set up my ambush, as you're saying, right there, you know, you got to chill on those ridges and wait until you can establish a direction. And you're right, maybe 40% of the time, but it works for me. It's worked a few times where I'm just like, okay, I know he's moving somewhere. And it's kind of half a dozen, one or the other, as far as if he's going to go up or down the draw. But those are some times where ambush hunting has worked for me is in those scenarios.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Exactly the same thing for me. Doing scenarios like that. And it's funny, you know, like you listen to, I mean, I'm trying to kind of compare this to like the Mountain Buck podcast that you'll listen to. A lot of people will say like, you don't leave your glass until mm-hmm. they're bedded, at least mm-hmm. even for like the second time that day. It's mm-hmm. just not the same here. And I think some of it's because you can see so far. I don't know, but yeah, I've listened to people talk about that before and I'm like, hell no. Mm-hmm. Like,
right.
I'm moving. If they're feeding like in a consistent direction, just like you're talking about, like mm-hmm. I'm going.
Yeah. Yeah. No. And I've experienced both. I mean, I've sat up there, I've had them bed down, I've moved. There I am over the ridge and they're not there. I mean, that's happened. I can't argue that that's not happened, but there's times and a lot of times I'm within pretty close striking distance, right? Like yeah. if they bed down, I can be there in 5 minutes. You know what I mean? Like I can be there in 10 minutes, but you know, you compare that to the high country. All right. He's bedded down. It's going to take me, you know, a couple hours to get over there, you know? And so, yeah, I think maybe that works, you know, letting them, making sure they're bedded down. But here, I think it pays to be aggressive, right? At least I do. I think it pays to be aggressive as far as you do want to make sure you know where they're bedded. If you have a hunting, you know, someone that you're hunting with, let them keep eyes on the deer and then you guys can, you know, establish your hand signals and all that, which is invaluable. But yeah, just making those moves once you think you know something as far as the direction of travel, or if you think that deer's going to stay bedded where he is for a while, go, you know, just go. And it's, there's 1,000 other things to look at in that scenario as well. It's not as simple as that, but I'm pretty aggressive in how that goes. If I'm confident, I know what that deer is going to do, or if I'm confident that deer is going to stay where he's at, you know, if he's bedded or something like that, I will close some distance because I want to be, maybe I won't close all of the distance, but I'm going to move from one glassing point, say at 1,000 yards to another point of visibility at maybe 400, to where if he gets up and starts doing something, I can make some plays that are going to take me a minimal amount of time.
Mm-hmm. Awesome. Yep. Yeah. I definitely think be more aggressive. I'm
yeah.
totally on that boat mm-hmm. around here and for these deer. So what's your, what's the day to day setup look like? Are you mm-hmm. usually getting on deer like right first thing in the morning? Like a lot of times we'll get on deer first thing in the morning. And then, you know, if they go to a spot, we just can't get them, or they go, let's say even on to the neighbors or onto private property or whatever. Then it's kind of like, you know,
yeah.
Now what do we do? So what's your day to day?
Yeah. I hike in a lot of times in the dark, you know, and I have predetermined glassing places that I'm going to, and I've hiked into a lot of those places. I know I'm not screwing up good stuff. You know what I mean? Like I know I'm going and I'm taking those routes to not booger up deer. You know what I mean? So I'm going to
logistics office place, bird logistics office place.
I'm going to try to get to those areas the best way I can without screwing up deer, without pushing coyotes, without doing those things, all in the dark. And then I set my 12x50s up on a tripod. I set my spotting scope right by my right knee. I run all outdoorsman's connections and outdoorsman's pan head. I can go from a binocular to a spotter in about 5 seconds, right? It's all quick. And that's my setup. And I'll sit there and I'll glass until I see the deer I want to shoot, or until I start getting burned out by the sun because it's 10 or 11 o'clock in the morning. I mean, I am extremely patient when it comes to glassing. And I feel like that's helped me immensely, you know? And then, so say I don't see a deer I want to shoot, or I don't see a deer that piques my interest that I want to make a move on. Then I start hunting shade, right? So then when it's noon, or hotter in the afternoon, I start looking at the pieces of this property that I'm on, whether it be public or whatever, where's the shade at? And then I'll start making moves and maybe go to different glassing points to create those angles. And I'll start literally just hunting shade. And that's worked well for me too. It's a pain to glass with. And that's where a lot of people sometimes may not see value in optics. You start looking in shade, you're going to start seeing value in optics, as far as, you know, everything doesn't necessarily perform similarly. it's hard on your eyes, right? But if you start making moves and looking into shade during that middle of the day, you're going to find deer. Yeah. You know, like you said, you know, where's water, you know, where are all those things that those deer might be traveling, but that middle of the day, I mean, they're just like, they're just like us. They're like, heck, man, it is hot out. I got all this fur and fat on me. Like, they're not, I promise they're not running marathons somewhere, right? They're going to go lay down. And it's just, you got to figure out where those are. And you find those places through shed hunting. You find those places through previous deer experiences. And you find those places through, where is the dark spots? You know, where's the shade at? And if you start looking at all those and putting all that together, you can find deer all day. You know, and it's just a matter of, and wind. Sorry, there's one more thing that, as you're familiar with in Nebraska, here we have a lot of really, really high winds, right? So even if they're comfortable, even if they're in the shade, if they're getting hammered with like 20 mile an hour winds in their face, or maybe even more, they're not going to want to be there, you know, unless it's really hot, to where that it's like a fan blowing on you. But a lot of times, if you have a really predominant wind out of the north or the south, that's where I start too sometimes. Okay, what's protected? I'm going to go look in all the protected spots, and bam, there's the deer, you know? So just thinking about like, okay, what's the environment giving me? And if I were a deer, where the heck would I want to be? Or if I was a human, where do I want to be, right? I want to be in some kind of protected draw that's going to, they're going to afford me some protection. Maybe there's some food in there, and if, and cool, if there's water in there, I'm good, you know? And sometimes you may not even see those deer during all morning because they're in one of those spots. They're in one of those spots where they bedded down, they get up, walk 10 feet, they take a drink of water, they get up and walk 20 yards, they get to eat grass, and then they walk 20 more yards and they sit in a bed that they've been living in their whole life, you know? And those are the deer that are tough. And most of the time, those are the deer that are big, right? Yeah. So it's just finding out, finding those deer that don't cover a lot of ground and that don't expose themselves very often is tough, because that's the environment that those smart deer live in. You know, I'm just going to chill in this draw my whole life because I'm getting shot at or whatever, you know, pickup truck out of the window, you know, those guys are around and it's just like, I'm just chilling in this draw, you know, living my life. And those are the hard ones as a bow hunter and as someone that may not be super familiar with that land. You'll never find that deer, you know, but if you spend some time and you may find them. You may not glass him up, but as far as in the mornings, but if you start thinking, okay, where's the shade at? And you start looking at shade, you may find him then, you know? So that's kind of my process anyway.
Dude, absolutely. I like it. I like it a lot. So I want to take just a quick second and thank our new sponsor, Onyx, that we just brought on. So that's exciting stuff. And
absolutely.
Yeah. So a big shout out to them and thanks for what they do for us. And I know that you're a big Onyx user. So I just wanted to get like what like your favorite feature about Onyx is.
Yeah. I mean, I just like how visual it is, right? You can run. It's kind of like, I mean, I don't know if there's different theories on it, but like, it's like picking up an iPhone. No one has to teach you how to run Onyx for the most part. It's very intuitive. And I feel like they've done a lot of work recently and all of their icons and all of their different colors, and you can make tracks on there. You can mark all your pins with pages of icons, right? To where you can basically spell out and then sharing points. I mean, that has helped me so much. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, even, you know, if I have a buddy that's out this year, happened 3 or 4 times, you know, guys, and excluding deer hunting, even, you know, even from a safety standpoint, like I had a buddy that had an elk tag in the hills, you know, and he would send me his exact location via Onyx and say, hey man, if anything happens, this is where I'm at. Like, that's awesome, right? That's something that we may not have had the opportunity, or may not have, if, you know, if no one was super, I don't even have to be there with him. Mm-hmm. He just zips me the point and I know where he's at. I mean, that's great. Obviously knowing all the property boundaries, landowners and different kinds of public land is awesome. Laying down tracks is cool. I've done that a few times to where, you know, I like to help other people out too. You know, I'll save a track and say, hey man, like literally follow this blue line. There's going to be some turkeys at the end of it. You know what I mean? Like, it's just very cool to be able to share stuff with a variety of experienced or inexperienced people. You know, hey, like follow this point, go to this spot, you know, and it's just cool to be able to do that. So like seamlessly, you know? So yeah, I've had great experience with Onyx. I've had it for a lot of years now. I pay for every state, you know, whatever the subscription is for 50 states, I do it. And it's just cool to look around. I've done, you know, goose hunting and stuff in Montana. I've done stuff in North Dakota. It's just cool to go to places, pull it up, and you got a ton of information there. Straight and the burns, man, yeah. Freaking having all the burn stuff on there. You know, I'm a firefighter for a living, but I mean, it's just cool. There's a lot of connecting the dots there when it comes to wildlife and burns that are there a lot, like especially elk hunters. I'm not an elk hunter. It's something I've never had the opportunity to do yet, but you know, I just hear people talking a lot about those, you know, hunting old burns, and be able to have a map of an old burn on Onyx is freaking sweet. I mean, it tells you exactly where it is, how many acres it was, tells you the name of the fire. You can go on Google and type in the name of the fire and maybe even find a more detailed map, maybe from forestry or something. Like, the sky's the limit when it comes to that darn app. I'm on it all the time. It's on my first home screen on my phone. I'm on it probably every day. So it's cool. I'm excited. I'm sure they'll do even more cool stuff in the future, but it's a heck of an asset to any version of a hunter. I don't care what you're hunting, you know, even if a trail runner or a mountain biker, there's tons of information, you know, to be gained on that thing.
Man. Yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm. And I need to get better at separating my pins, like, you know, mine's just like a sea of red X's currently, but I need to change it. Yeah. Cause we'll be like, Leah's so good at organizing hers. And if she's driving down the road, like, you know, she'll be driving down the road like 3 years ago and see a bear up alongside the hill, like in the middle of summer, and she'll drop a pin with like a yellow bear marker. And so then the other day we're like, where should we go look for bears? And she's like, oh, I saw a bear here. Like, she's got them all spread out. So organized.
Yeah.
I'm not as organized, but it's so nice. So that's on my list here before too much longer, before season starts, is to get everything kind of organized more. But it's a really a hell of an asset. And then especially in the country that we're talking about, it's not like you're in a gigantic national forest. You could be in BLM or you could be on smaller tracks of public or walk-in or something, and you might they're just not as big a track. So you can easily hop the fence and be on private that you're not supposed to be on. So
that's, I know some great, and it's crazy to think about, but I know some awesome spots out here that I haven't personally shot a deer there, but I've helped buddies drag deer out of. And it is a section big, 640 acres, 1 mile by 1 mile of BLM or something like that, that gets overlooked. And if it wasn't for Onyx and knowing exactly where those boundaries are, I don't know that I'd feel comfortable even hunting it. Right. But to know, be like, man, that draw looks good. And it's like, holy crap, that little piece is public, you know, and being able to like have confidence in that and being able to, you know, kind of see where you're at. And you're hunting boundaries there. I'm not going to lie, but you're well within your rights to do that. And, you know, that's something that I wouldn't have done, I don't know, pre Onyx days or pre any boundary type of app. You know, you got a map, but it's hard to tell where the heck you are on a paper map, you know, for the most part.
Dude. Yeah, absolutely. It's a great product, and they're giving all of the Rockcast users or listeners 20% off.
Excellent.
Or $20 off the Elite product. That's going to be the all 50 states. So if you go to onyx.com/hunt and type in the code Rockcast, Rockcast, it's going to get you 20% off. So go check that out.
Excellent.
Sweet. So I want to touch on gear a little bit.
Sure.
Roll into this next section. You know, and I think that this is more of a for like Eastern guys coming out west type of deal. I run the outfitting business in Nebraska. So I am like, I'm dealing with a lot of guys, and honestly, most of them, they're all coming from back east. I think I've had maybe two dudes that have come from west of my location. Yeah.
Right.
And most of them come from back east. You know, they all ask if they need spotting scopes. They all ask what they need for binoculars. Mm-hmm. Ironically enough, I have to like beg people to bring range finders because they're just not used to using range finders, and they don't think it's a big deal.
I admit this may be stupid, but 20 yards or 30 yards in their home woods or 60 yards down some draw may look the same. Yep. You know what I mean? And it's hard for people to get that when they're removed from their home area. So yeah, rangefinder is huge.
Dude, absolutely. So I want to run through your optic setup and what you got, what you like using.
Yeah. So for optics, I've ran Vortex's Razor. They're I guess it'd be their Gen 1. I got the 85 big brick. I haul that thing around for the most part. And then like I said, I have a ProMaster tripod. It's a carbon fiber tripod with a removable leg that acts as like a trekking pole. I've never used it as a trekking pole. I have used it as a tent support, right? For like a Cimarron or something like that. So, you know, it's just, I kind of like to have some stuff that kind of acts, you know, as far as dual purpose. And then, like I said, outdoorsman's panhead, I would fight anyone for that thing. That thing is money. I really like the ability to grid search stuff and have a system to it, right? Like instead of maybe just loosening or tightening like some kind of head and moving it around, like I can go a half of, like, say you're, you know, with your binocular view, I go up half a view, lock it, run right to left, come up another half, lock it, run right to left. You know what I mean? And like, know that there's a system to what you're doing. And then obviously for your glass to be completely still allows you to see almost everything everywhere, especially out here, to your point, it's kind of a little bit more of a plain and optically easy, way to look at country out here versus like some gnarly canyon with a bunch of rock, a bunch of timber, a bunch of shade, a bunch of, you know, sloping terrain. Out here, it's kind of nice, easy, you know, grass draws, or they'll have cedars and stuff in them. But in retrospect to the high country stuff, it's pretty plain, at least in my opinion. It's a little bit easier on the eyes, you know, so having something that you could get dead solid is money. So yeah, I got Leupold BX4s, I think they are. Anyway, they're 12 by 50s. I like the 12 by 50s. There is times where they're a little tight as far as, you know, maybe looking at an opposing hillside that might be, you know, say 600 yards away. 12s are a little much for that scenario, but most of the time I do like having the 12s. Guys could run 8s or 10s. In my opinion, and still see a lot of stuff.
Yeah.
You know, as far as coming from the, you know, if I lived in Ohio again, I don't know why the heck I'd have 12s. You know, I'd probably have 8s or 10s at most, you know, so don't, you know, guys definitely don't need to have, you know, 12 by 50s to come out here. They can see it. If they're patient enough, they can see anything they want with 8s or 10s. It's just, I'm out here all the time and I'm never looking at something 100 yards away from me. And if I am, I'm probably trying to shoot it. So, you know, it's just different, you know? So that's my glassing setup. I really like the outdoorsman's little adapters, you know, like as far as what you screw onto your spotting scope and stuff, because it makes for a really fast transition. And that's paid off so many freaking times where you catch a buck feeding and he's getting ready to crest a hill or maybe hide himself behind a rolling hillside or something like that. And for you to be able to be like, crap, like, is that a shooter or not? And then you switch over between your binocular or your spotter and, like I said, less than 5 seconds. Like, that's a pretty huge deal. I'm not unscrewing anything. I'm not, you know, tinkering with adapters or anything. You know, it's a pretty seamless system. So that's huge in my opinion. Trying to think what else. Rangefinder. I got a pile of rangefinders that I've been trying out. I this year I hunted with a freaking Leupold like 2800 that I used for my precision rifle competitions and stuff, really just because I forgot it was in there. And then and I'm like, I actually don't mind it because I use it a lot in the off season anyway. So I tried that and it was fine. It has a little more magnification than your standard ones do, but I didn't hate it. But any rangefinder is freaking invaluable. Like I said, terrain just looks different out here, especially if you don't live out here. I mean, I test myself all the time. Be like, I wonder if I'm going to call that Cedar 46. Well, it's not, it's 61. And you're like, dang, that does not look like 61 yards, you know? And so it's just, it's hard to train your eye if you don't do it every day.
Yeah. So, yeah. Rangefinders are big. We were just like out this last weekend and we were shooting at a rock. just for fun.
Yeah, I saw that. I saw that video. Yep.
Yeah. Yeah. And we're just like, how far is that? That's like, dude, it's like 550, like maybe, maybe closer to six, but yeah, like 550. And yeah, she lazed it and it was like 698 or something like that. And I'm like, God dang. Nice. Yeah. It can be so, so deceiving. I've been using SIG for the last couple of years. I really like those Kilo rangefinders. I use the 2400 probably the most. One thing I like about those things is inside of them, there's a setting that it's called best or last. So, the last one you can shoot through grass. So if there's grass, like
that's a huge deal, right?
Yep, like 10 yards in front of you or something, but your whatever you're ranging is like 80 yards or 70 yards or whatever.
Yeah.
But you don't want to completely get up above the grass because you're gonna show your big head. You can put that thing on last and it will kind of shoot through the grass and not be.
Yeah, I could see where that'd be super beneficial because there's been, you know, there's a lot of times where you're forced to, it's not that you don't want to stand up, but you have to get a range on the darn thing. Right. So you keep on, you're clicking a mouse 1,000 times and you're just getting a blank screen on your rangefinder and you're freaking out. And then you just kind of keep on lifting yourself up. And then by the time you do that, game's over. He sees you, you know, trying to get a range on him or something. So I could see where a feature like that would be pretty awesome. I have a SIG Tango 6 rifle scope on my comp rifle. Nice. And that thing is freaking sweet. I like the internal level that it's got in there. The lights on it are kind of, they come in super handy, but different conversation, but yeah, that's cool.
Same thing, but I think people definitely got to have a range finder. That's for damn sure.
Yeah.
But other than that, I mean, a lot of it, just like you said, like if you have 8 or 10 power binoculars, like you don't have to have 15s to come out here or to go anywhere else out west for that.
No, not at all. Not, but if you're in your position and you do it every day, maybe my answer would change. But if you want to come out here, you don't need to blow $1,000 just to get 12s as opposed to your 10s or opposed to the 8s that you have. You know, spend your money somewhere else. You know, I don't care. What do you use for a sight? I was just curious. Like, what do you use for archery sight?
I like a Spot Hog Tommy Hog.
Gotcha. Cool.
Mm-hmm. Yep. I roll 5 pins with the bottom being my reference for a slider.
Yeah. I think that's, in my opinion, I shot a single pin black gold for my first season out here. And, then I went to a 3-pin mover. And that's been, I shoot an 80-pound Hoyt RX ones and my first pin's 30. I shoot 30, 40, 50, and then my 50 is my slider. But having the ability to do that, and I almost all of my buddies that are East Coast that I've hunted with, 40 yards is a long shot, right? And they'll come out and bow hunt with me and stuff. And before you know it, not that I'm promoting a 100-yard shot, but before you know it, I got them out to 80 to 100 yards. And then we go back to 40. And their groups are half what they were, you know what I mean? And it's just like being able to, I don't care if you just move that slider just for practice, but flinging arrows at 60, 70, 80, 90 yards all summer. And then you have a bedded buck at 41, man, that 41's pretty easy, you know, compared to what it used to be, you know, before maybe you started pushing yourself. So I would really encourage people to run or at least take a look at one of those slider sites. And I, you know, maybe they can be a little bit confusing if you're brand new to them, but if you get the right guy to explain that to you, it has a lot of benefits and it's helped me out a few times, you know, just having multiple pins and then the ability to really fine tune in, like, all right, that when that deer stands up, he's going to be at, you know, 58 and I can crank my bow right to 58. And you say, it just gives you more, in my mind, it gives me confidence, you know.
Oh,
I'm not trying. Not trying to pin gap anything. I'm not kind of guessing. If he's at 58 and my sight's at 58, even if I have a form issue or maybe there's a little bit of wind, or if my nerves get the best of me, like there's some error built into that system, right? Versus, you know, well, I'm gonna put my 50 on his back. I'm not sure where my arrow is gonna hit, but hopefully I'm guessing correctly. Some people are great at that, but I never was. And so I like having that multi-pin mover is just money, in my opinion. I was just curious what you ran.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. Yep. Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. I love those things. I've I've probably run them. Gosh, I think my first bow had a spot hog on it, because that's just what the guy had at the time when my dad took me to set the bow up. And the guy's like, yeah, spot hogs are like the best. We're putting one on there. And I've just stuck with it. And then, you know, as I got older and more experienced, realized like how good those sights are, you know, just right, how they are. Yeah. And then I've always just stuck with them. So
That's cool. In my opinion, any version of a mover is neat. Even if you don't use it, even if you never touch your sight all year and most of your stuff that you shoot is inside 50, being able to practice at that further distance is going to make you such a better archer in every aspect. Right. And so I always encourage people to do that is, you know, find some space, right? I don't care if you live in the middle of the city, go find some space and try and shoot at some distance, and you'd be amazed at what you're going to learn, you know, as far as your form, maybe how your everything might look good at 25, but all of a sudden you're throwing some weird stuff at say 55. Well, maybe you're shooting the wrong spine arrow, or maybe, you know, maybe your broadhead didn't really shoot as well as you thought because your bow's out of tune. You may not see that at 20, you know, and it's just being able to have that ability to really press out there and prove that your system is consistent. I promise you, if your system is consistent at say 80 yards, your bow setup is perfect, you know? And it's just, if it's not, something's out of whack and you can fix that. But it's cool to have that ability with that slider. So I think that's a big thing. I just wanted to talk a little bit about is you know, having, and I don't really care about the make of it, just have some confidence in it and learn how to run that sucker. And that's going to help you out a lot.
Right. Well, dude, that goes for, I mean, rifles or bows, like your shooting proficiency needs to be high. And that's what I've got a guy coming out like from Wisconsin, and he's like, yeah, what, you know, what kind of shape do I need to be in? And I'm like, dude, no, like shoot. Like you have to be a proficient shooter. I try to beat that into everybody's heads.
You can create opportunities for people as an outfitter. It's even kind of, in my opinion, your job is, you know, you look at who you have, what you're working with, and you can create opportunities because you know the land, right? You can create opportunities because you know, man, if this guy's shooting a, you know, a freaking souped up 6.5 PRC and he sent me videos of him blitzing a piece of steel at a mile, man, that canyon that's 500 yards wide, we can just go sit there, you know? But if you're not sure, and if I mean, I'm assuming you've seen it hundreds of times where it's like, well, that's another miss. We'll try and find another deer, you know? And it's just like, just spend a little bit of time with your system and learn that, you know?
Yep. Shoot with your broadheads on.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Yep. Yeah. It's definitely important. So man, some other gear stuff, this leads into a kind of another question that's going to be looped into the gear. I want to talk about backpacks and what you're doing to get those deer out of there. Cause a lot of the places I'm sure you're going, it's walk in or, you can't drive to everything. So, and with that, you know, how consistent or like, what's your average of like how far you're going off the road in some situations, like these flatlands?
Man, I make some pretty dumb choices sometimes. I go pretty far. not really regarding a whole lot, unless it's really warm. I won't regard a whole lot as far as how far. I'll just put my head down and keep walking. I remember multiple sheep hunts where it's just like, okay, if I could just make it to that next rock, you know what I mean? Like I've been there. So this country to me, I'll walk as far as you want me to, but that's me. I'm 6'4". You know, 230, I got a big stride on me. I can walk some legs, you know, like I can go. But, you know, as far as how far, you know, you got to think about that. You know, if you're walking 5 miles in, man, you're going to have to figure out how to carry that mule deer, maybe all at one load, which I did this past year on my rifle buck. I got him all out in one load, and that was probably four miles in. You know, but that's a learning curve too, you know, as far as, you know, how the heck do you quarter up this deer and, you know, if you want to save the hide or not to mount it, or, you know, that's all a bunch of bulk there, you know, so figuring out how to pack that buck and that's where the rubber meets the road, as far as what kind of pack you're running or not really what kind. There's a lot of different kinds, and, you know, to me, packs are kind of like insoles and shoes, right? They fit everybody differently. I can't recommend an insole to you. You need to try them, you know? So as far as different packs, there's a lot of great companies out there that make some sweet packs, but you know, those style packs, you may not think you need it, or you think, man, I'm going to cut weight and I'm going to go ultralight and carry this, you know, maybe this frameless or this real light pack in. And then all of a sudden you knock a deer down, you're going to find out real quick, this pack is not fun, right? It's not comfortable. It doesn't have the amount of support you need, which all of that can expand to injury. You know, it can expand to, you get that load on your back and it's not solid. I mean, you're going to blow out a knee or an ankle or something bad could happen too. Right. So like a little bit of insurance built into your pack is cheap money, in my opinion. So, I've ran Kefaru packs. I've had two or three of those when I was in Alaska. Mm-hmm. Right now I'm running an XO, K2, still have a few of those Kefaru packs. We used one to pack out an elk a few years ago that my buddy shot in the Black Hills. Just something that has a little bit of rigidity to it, and it has a solid frame. I like that XO's ability to basically take the bag off, but it has a load sling in it, put the meat in there and sandwich it back together. At least get a real heavy first load out. If you can't carry the whole deer out at once, that's cool. Just get a real heavy first load out. But to your point, you got to start thinking about what that actually means. So if you're, you know, if you're 5 miles in and you're going to take half of that load out, that's a 10 mile decision. You know what I mean? Like you're going to be walking. And I think a lot of people may not really think about it in that term, but I mean, I don't have anything else to do. I got headlamps and a bunch of batteries. I can just go through the night, but at the same time, you want to, you know, just kind of have a little reality check conversation with yourself especially when you're talking big stuff like elk or moose or something like that. Like, man, I don't know, that as good as that cliff or hillside looks over there, they may not be an option, you know, as far as if you're thinking meat preserve, you know, preserving the meat, or, you know, am I physically able to do this? Just something to think about for sure. That's a good point. Good question.
Yeah, man, it's always funny. Like, I shot that bull in Wyoming and I packed the first load out, and then it got dark, so I hung all the meat up and whatnot, came back the next day. I remember, so I walked up the hill, got a load, came down. It wasn't too bad, but I remember when I was on my way back up and I'm like, I'm not walking back up this hill again. Like,
correct.
It's going all out right now. Like, that's how knees get blown to pieces. Definitely plan on, I don't know, three. I mean, I got mine out, my bull out in three trips. It wasn't very far. Yeah. It was like a mile off the road. Mm-hmm. But a couple of those loads were freaking heavy. And that's where you see
maybe someone on the East Coast or someone getting into this style of hunting that's new, that's where you see your dollars spent, is in those scenarios, you know, as far as when it comes down to like what kind of boots you're running or what kind of pack you have. I mean, yeah, I get it. The crap's expensive, but that's where you see your dollars, right? On those second and third trips, once you shoot that elk or that deer of a lifetime, where you're trying to hike yourself out of here, you know, that's where that gear starts to really develop. And you're like, man, I am glad I got this, you know? And it's just, that's a hard pill to swallow for somebody that's getting into this, because I've been there, man. It's intimidating. All this gear and how, where do you spend this money that you really kind of don't have, you know, but you find a way to spend it, you know, where do you spend it? What do I buy? Like, it's hard. You get like yourself and, you know, there's other people in the industry that get to test a lot of stuff. And I feel like people need to reach out to those people and just ask them. Not that, like, to my earlier point, like, you can't recommend a set of insoles to somebody. Everybody has different needs there, but you can at least go through gear a little bit and say, hey man, like, this didn't work for me and here's why. And maybe the whys don't matter to that person. Like, well, yeah, I wouldn't do that anyway. So that maybe that would work for them, but you can just, you know, and I've tried a lot of gear too. And I've helped a lot of people, like, trim out a lot of wasted time and a lot of wasted money by saying, my recommendation might be kind of expensive, like that outdoorsman's head. Yeah. Like that outdoorsman's panhead, like, yeah, that's some serious coin there, but that's my favorite piece of gear I have, you know, and I wouldn't give that up for anything. And so it's just a matter of being able to try that stuff out. And to your experience with like with your bowl, packing that out, you know, I'm sure you were glad you were wearing what you were wearing and you were packing out what you had, you know what I mean? As far as it, you know, you go to some place and buy just a generic, not that brand matters, but something that isn't constructed as well, or something that's not built as bomb-proof as it is, you're going to see it in those scenarios. And I promise you, you start seeing it in those scenarios, the fun level goes way down. You know, when you have a piece of gear that fails, or you have something that just rips apart on you that you were banking on using.
Yeah.
When you're in the middle of nowhere.
Oh yeah, dude, I can tell you, I was running a Kfaru, and I can tell you that I did not want to be running anything lesser in that
exactly type of
situation, you know, like right, something right. That's just like a basic Cabela's frame pack or something that has like no load lifting. Oh my God. Like it sucks packing meat, dude.
I got a story for you. When I was up in Alaska, there was an older gentleman that I got to know really well. And he had no sense of like the newer innovations with packs. I mean, and this guy was an absolute killer, right? He had shot over 30 sheep. He was just an outdoorsman through and through. But older, he was in his 70s, about 140 pounds, just like he could walk me into the dirt, right? But this guy carried two Cabela's like open frame packs. When he went sheep hunting for 30 days. He flew in, he got dropped off, and they picked him up 30 days later. And he carried two packs, and he would leapfrog those packs up and around. And he had campsites and stuff that he would go to completely solo. But he had a 13 or 14 pound Browning medallion rifle. And he hung it off of the upper frame of his pack with this metal hook that you would hang like an extension cord, like in your garage. Like he drilled that through with his pack, and he hung it there via the sling, and he would basically like carry it that way. And I'm like, Joe, like there is like amazing packs that do all these things that you're trying to do. And he put one on, and I think we were packing out a moose actually. And I gave him my pack with a hind quarter in it, and it weighed about as much as he did. Right. But he could carry that thing no problem. But as far as in his older pack, not that it even failed on him, it actually held together fine. But it carried so much differently, you know, and you would never know that unless you put it into play. But, you know, just like you said, with that Kfaru pack, the way that those things carry in any pack with that type of construction is worlds different than, you know, somewhat of a generic or a cheaper version of what, it, you know, that's trying to replicate.
Mm-hmm. Dude, yeah. Yeah, it's pretty nice. Are you running the smallest EXO bag?
No, I run I think it's a 3400. It's the older gen, and then when I go up, I'm going to go up and help a buddy sheep hunt in Alaska this year, and I think I'm going to run their newer bigger one. I just need more room for like a, you know, a 7 or so day hunt. So
for sure. I think for some of these hunts like we're talking about, these lower country hunts, and then it'll roll right over into the higher country if you want to. From like Kfaru is what I've been running for quite some time, and that new Striker XL is badass. You know, just that load sling, you know, they have shelves on all their bags, but this one's like got the bag portion, and then the back is like a load sling, and it's just quicker to use or to deploy, if you will, than a regular like load shelf. But that's what I've kind of been recommending to people for some of these hunts that are like day hunts, but you're going to need to haul some stuff out.
Yeah, it gives you that ability to like create, like expand mindlessly based, you know what I mean? Because there's been pack designs out there that I've tried that it's like, man, I need to like Xerox in like the directions to this, because I'm not going to remember how the heck to transform this pack into this configuration. You know, it's just a lot. Sometimes they're not as simple, but to have something like that, that's simple, it's always on you. It's not something like an accessory that you have to bring, you know, or like clips that you have to clip into. It's all there. To have that ability is awesome. To take up, say, even an 1800, you know, cubic foot pack that you would, or cubic inch pack that you would mess around with the majority of the season, and turn that into a, a meat hauling son of a gun that can haul something, you know, big within a few minutes is invaluable.
Right. Yeah,
for sure.
Hell yeah. Well, dude, we're rolling up on an hour, but one question that I missed that we had from a listener was how to make sense of thermals in the low country and just wind and things like that. And I think you're the, you're the perfect guy to talk about this for sure.
Yeah. So thermals, I pay attention to them. I definitely do. I was just to change up a little bit. I was on a fire in the hills about a month ago. We had a big wildfire in the Black Hills, and we were on a hand crew down in this canyon. And I just have a mind that basically always thinks about when I'm fighting wildfires, I'm basically just shed hunting. But you know, I'm always looking for antlers and all that crap. But basically, we were in this canyon, and I'm paying attention to the winds. And we can see it via smoke, right? All these different layers of smoke in this canyon. And it, I don't have a great answer for the hills, right? That is a hornet's nest of problems as far as, I don't know how the elk hunters do it. I guess thermals is probably the only answer. You know, in these huge canyons where you get so much turbulent, like upper winds, and then you get updrafts and downdrafts. It is a nightmare. And I don't know. I don't spend much time in the Black Hills as far as hunting deer, because it's mostly whitetail and I'm just not interested in it. But as far as out in the plains and badlands type areas, you know, thermals aren't as big of a deal as they would be like in the high country. I mean, I look at it, but this year, for example, on the archery deer that I shot, I didn't move on that buck until I had a good, like, predominant wind, right? I could have moved on him when everything was like dead still, when thermals would maybe matter more, but I'm a big odds guy. That's just how I think about a lot of those stocks. Like, what are the odds that this deer is going to pick me out? And if I think that that deer's got a pretty darn good chance to find me, maybe I won't move on him then. I'll be patient. But this year I waited until the wind started blowing and it started, you know, granting me a little more movement to where if I do screw up as far as stepping on something or whatever, that deer is going to have a harder time picking me out. So when it comes to thermals, the only, in my opinion, most of the time that the only time that thermals really matter is if you have a really like low velocity wind, maybe not, you know, not ripping as far as like, you know, 15 to 20 miles an hour, and getting close to these big mule deer when they're bedded or even feeding is sometimes really hard when it's dead still. So I don't a lot of times, you know, I'll just, if it's like just a dead still, you see like, you know, all the bugs and stuff through your glass, you see them, you know, just dead still, just humming around doing their own thing, and they're not getting pushed by the wind. I don't move on those deer. I just don't like to anyway. I'll wait and follow them until they bed down, and then I'll get a 10 or 15 mile an hour wind, and I'll disregard the thermals because the wind's going to win that battle most of the time anyway. And, you know, I'll just kind of go at it from that perspective. I don't know that it answers that gentleman's question, but I don't know. I don't necessarily look at the wind or look at the thermals a whole lot. I don't know. What's your experience when it comes to like Nebraska type stuff?
Same thing.
You know, lower. Yeah.
I don't really pay attention to it, to be honest. Yeah, I mean,
I don't.
Yeah. I think in some of those canyons, you know, like really early in the morning, I think that you can get some shifty things happening depending how deep that canyon is. If you're like, you know, if they're feeding in the bottom or something and you're on top, like, I think I've got a little bit more shiftiness there, but as soon as that predominant wind comes up, I don't even pay attention to the thermals.
Yeah. And I don't either. I haven't been in that position. What dictates, and we've talked, like when we first started this podcast, talked a lot about like visibility, like you only being able to see, you know, 20% of a big canyon, where I can see 90% of where I'm looking, you know what I mean? So what dictates where I move on deer, whether it be above or below, is just where all the other deer are, you know, trying to find them all, figure out, oh man, there's a doe that's 40 yards above the buck I want to shoot. So that doe is going to pick me out way before I even get to that deer. You know what I mean? And so the bottom approach isn't an option. So maybe I'll go high, you know, like that's what dictates that for me. It very rarely, or if ever, have I thought about things through the thermal aspect.
Yep. Yeah. Dude, same thing. Just obey the wind.
Exactly right. Yeah. Or like I said, this year, I just waited on it because it helped me out. I got in between a couple cedars. I got a little closer than I wanted to get on that buck. He was feeding and he had moved about 10 yards more than I thought he did. And I came over the hill. There he was. I drew back and there, and I had some wind going to where the cedars that I was in were moving. And it just gave me the ability to draw. And he looked up and stared at me. And we stared at each other for probably 10 to 15 seconds. And he just couldn't pick me out because of the movement, right? I'm all geared up. You know, I run a lot of the First Light Cypher stuff. I really just like that pattern. And I don't know. He just couldn't find me. Not because he couldn't see me. We were staring at each other, but he just couldn't pick anything out. And that afforded me the opportunity to settle my pin, aim, squeeze, shot, you know, it just bought me some time because I had all that movement. You know, had I made mm-hmm. that stock 2 hours earlier, I don't know, maybe he would have busted me drawing, you know, like it's just having, and I wouldn't have done that. I wouldn't have made that decision to wait, you know, in previous years. It's just through a little bit of experience via failure where I'm like, dang, if I just waited on the wind, I probably could have got a lot closer to that buck, you know.
And sound too, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Right. Yeah. So all that stuff makes a big difference. So yeah, I think those guys that are coming out west, the first thing you're going to do is cuss the wind because it's always blowing compared to any other place. But if you learn to use the wind into your advantage, it helps a little bit, you know, so that's good. Good mm-hmm. thing to do.
Dude, mm-hmm. hell yeah.
Yeah,
absolutely. Well, is there anything else that you can think of that you want to, or something that you want to leave people with?
Man, I don't know. I'm no big philosopher or anything like that. I just, you know, I enjoy hunting. I enjoy helping people out. You know, chances are if I come across someone on public land that worked as hard or as got back as far as I did, which I'm sure there's people that outwork me. It's a pleasure to hunt with those guys. And you know what I mean? And it's cool to, you're sharing that stuff with those people. So, you know, enjoy your time out there, you know, be safe. Have some plans in the process as far as like sharing points on Onyx and things like that.
Yeah.
And just, you know, kind of respect what you got, because, you know, coming from, you know, being an Ohio boy, it's an awesome deal out here, and being able to hunt in these big areas is a privilege. So, you know, just keep at it. And if anyone that's got any questions for me, I'd be glad to answer them, you know, via Instagram or whatever.
Hell yeah. Well, mm-hmm. I appreciate you coming on again.
Sure.
And we'll have to have you on some other time. Maybe we'll talk about shooting next time.
Yeah, do a lot of that. Do a lot of rifle stuff or bow or whatever. So that'd be cool.
Awesome. Mm-hmm. Thanks, dude.